But we're right. But it's a subject for today. And you don't have to be crazy to do what I'm going to try to do this morning, but it helps. And what I'm up to is really an impossible task. And I thought I'd be a little more prepared by, say, a couple of weeks than I am for this moment. Because I was selected to give the Wesley Spink Lectures at the University of Minnesota in October. And these involve a series of lectures which have to be in book form at the time of your appearance there. And I'm just, about 6 weeks off where I should be right now. And I really shouldn't be here at all, but I am. And the general subject is animals aging in the aged. What have we learned from animals that will tell us something about this? And I often dress for the occasion, and I did for today. Somebody's already guessed what it is. All right. Just look at my big ears, and they're extended down here. And it's a rabbit. Last year I had one like this for a rat. I think my faculty gave me that one. But now, why do I wear this rabbit shirt? Well, the rabbit has been used a very great deal in one of the areas that I'm going to discuss today. The two areas that I'm going to discuss, well, I better show you a slide, an overhead projector. I wonder what I did with those. Oh, yes, here they are. Yeah, let's just look at one thing before we go any further. I don't know how many of you can see that. Probably not very many.
Lower it just a little bit.
Lower it? I wonder how you do that. Perfect. About like that, huh? A little more? Is that too low?
Right there.
How's that?
Fine.
Right now, what we have here looks kind of fuzzy to me. But here are the percent deaths from selected causes. The percentages here, these are the males and these are the females. And you can kind of select what you die from. Because one of my premises is same as my old friend Hans Enen in Richland, Washington. None of us will ever get out of here alive. Right? Now, and cardiovascular, the two biggies are in this country and in the industrial world, are cardiovascular disease, and they as you grow older, their chances are better from dying from it, or worse, depending on how you look at it. And cancer is second. But the deaths from cardiovascular disease, chiefly coronary heart disease, is greater than all the others combined. And that's why I'm talking about those two today. I'm talking about the biggies and to an extent of what animals have told us about this. Now, the other thing that I want to make perfectly clear is that and also has to do with rabbits, really. And I'll say more about this afternoon, but mothers are right when they have, especially the first baby. My baby is unique. You know, there's none other like it. They've all told me that. But it doesn't take very long before they say, why don't you act like your brother or sister, you know? I mean, pretty soon they forget it, and we all forget it, don't we? It's an average. We always compartmentalize them. I'll probably talk about this. I'll even be talking about it at Vespers tonight. But I'm really hung up on this We're all different. And we're different in a lot of ways. Now the statisticians will draw you a normal curve, won't they? They draw you a normal curve, and most people fit into this normal curve. And here's the number at a certain level of anything. Huh? And they'll say, well, 95% of them are within this. And the 5% are the outliers. No, they're outside the pale here. But that's with one, looking at one thing, right? So it's 950 out of 1,000, maybe, that would fit within this range, right? Right, if you go to two variables, it probably goes down to 900 out of 1,000. If you go to 10, it probably goes down to maybe 600, I don't know. But if you get up to 100, it's only 6 out of 1,000 that will fit in sort of within that. You see what I mean? And as you get to more and more variables, you reach a point, nobody's like anybody else. We all know that, but we don't treat people that way. And the same with physicians. And the same way, not so much with veterinarians. I'll tell you why, because they do to an extent with cattle. With some cattle. Out on the range. Huh? But when it comes to a dog, most of those don't look alike, do they? And we went into that yesterday. And even and alley cats, none of them look all alike. So it isn't. We don't tend that way, but a lot of the data goes this way, and you're going to be very distressed. I think when I finish here, almost as distressed as I am before I start, because of these problems. For example, like rabbits. Well, I knew this because I was into experimental work fairly early, and this bugs you really terrible because you run an experiment and it doesn't come out the way you think it should. But that's the exciting thing about research. But one animal doesn't show anything, and another animal, you know, that's real bad. Early in the business, I remember one fellow was checking something on rats, and he knew nothing would happen to the control, so he never touched them, but he went in and stroked the others, and they did better. It didn't have anything to do with probably what he was giving them. It was just gentling them. So you got to watch that kind of a thing. But when I went to, became a sheep herder for General Electric Company, I bought a bunch of purebred Suffolk sheep, really neat sheep. But when we went through and we picked them out for uniformity, and then we divided them up into groups. And I'll never forget group 4A. I was doing radioiodine uptake studies on them. And there was a factor of 10 difference in the thyroid uptake of these normal sheep. And then I met Roger Williams from University of Texas. And he did a book on biochemical uniqueness or variability. And he quoted some work from a fellow named Brown. And old Brown, he decided to collect up a whole bunch of experimental rabbits that they were using, you know, real uniform rabbits. And he did a lot of biochemical studies, but he also weighed organs. And a 20-fold difference was not uncommon. Up to 80-fold difference in one organ, I remember. Happened to be the spleen, which we'd expect. And so you have to recognize this. And I think our goal in life should be to treat everyone as an individual, and this will become very obvious in for example, these two diseases that I'm talking about today. And statistics, there are liars, damn liars, and statistical liars. I'm going to show you some data because it was brought home to me because when I was doing graduate work at the University of Washington School of Medicine, there's a fellow there named Cato Orn Gudbrandsen. He was from Norway, and he did a thesis. And
a thesis. Yeah. And he, that's what he called it. And I'll tell you what happened at this time. A fellow named Keyes, Ansel Keyes, University of Minnesota, famous heart man. And what he did was to say, he went to the World Health Organization data, and he said, it's pretty clear. There's a definite correlation between the amount of fat and animal products you eat is directly correlated with the mortality rate from cardiovascular disease in the age group 50 to 59. It's just as clear as can be, and he selected the populations of Japan, which has an exceedingly low intake of fat at that time, or animal fat, and had a low mortality cardiovascular disease. In Italy, it was pretty low. And then he looked at Canada and Australia, and then USA is way up here. A beautiful curve. And this Norwegian says, we talked about it, and I says, yeah, I think it's more complicated than that. And he says, no question about it. He says, you know, the Norwegians, they're eating all this stuff, and I know what they're eating because I eat it at home. You know, it's rumagraut and sprutbakkels and fattigmann and whipped cream and they like fat, you know. And he says it's just doesn't add up. And so he started studying this, and he drew a curve, which I'll show you now. We have two curves to show you. You see that, right? This is Ansel Keyes' curve. Is the red one? See, he was really proud of himself. This really looked good. See, until Kato came along, and he says, well, if Ansel Keyes can take five populations or six, so can I, from the same data, huh? What? We just went through lowering it, Chief. I'll show it to you when we get home. In fact, I got one in our cupboard. And what he did, he took Chile, which has a high incidence of mortality from heart disease, took Israel, which has pretty high rates, and he took Austria and Switzerland and German Federated Republic, and he took Norway, which is had a very low incidence of cardiovascular or coronary heart disease and cardiovascular disease, and he drew just exactly the opposite curve. Huh? Well, what do you say about that? And so he's tried to analyze this. Now, what else can be going on here? And he looked at other correlations on what was happening in these populations. Unfortunately, it wasn't corrected for caloric intake. And he found out that in some of this, he could probably get a far better correlation if he looked at, say, sugar intake, or protein intake, or the amount of work. And then he looked at English data, and he found out that probably the best correlation with cardiovascular heart disease was the number of motor cars, television sets, and radio. That was bad. These are always hazardous. In fact, I remember one of the best correlations you saw with illegitimate births over a period of time in England. It was correlated with the growth of the Methodist Church. They've done it with the Lutheran Church, okay? So beware of those correlations. That's one of the first lessons. And here's radio and TV down below there, purple and green, the mortality versus the TV and radio.
Put it on the screen.
Yeah, I'll put it on the screen. Okay. So that's That ain't too bad correlation in the areas I work. So I mentioned several things now of what we call risk factors.
Huh?
These are risk factors. And but people really got hung up on cholesterol. And if you don't know how to spell cholesterol now, it isn't the TV's fault, and it isn't Mazola oil or corn oil's fault, huh? Because you see it all the time, because the word is that if you take animal fat and fat and all these things, you're in big trouble. And you go to the doctor, and he takes and determines whether you got cholesterol and now triglycerides in the blood. What I haven't mentioned either is hypertension. That's the risk factors that we look most at now. I've talked about really fat in the blood, and I'm gonna dwell on that first. But it's hyperlipidemia. We like to doctor it up. Instead of fat in the blood, we call it hyperlipidemia. Okay. And hypertension, we know also that with diabetes, especially early diabetes, you're going to have a lot more hardening of the arteries. And also, the family history makes just an awful lot of difference. I'll never forget what Sir John Hammond told me many years ago. He was a great scientist, animal scientist in England. And we were talking about aging and how to ensure a long lifespan. And he says, well, I'll tell you what old man Pearl told me in 1908. If you want to ensure a long lifespan, pick a mother with a long lifespan. Well, it was too late for me. But she lived to be 80. So that's better than average. And then, of course, cigarette smoking, which I won't get into, except to say that it's probably the worst addiction going. It's costing you and I more than anything else. That I know, and you got to be insane to start it. Now I want to talk about hyperlipidemia, or fat in the blood, and give you some of the skin on that. And there's some new data on this. We're always, you know, what's true today? What's the truth today in science? May not be true tomorrow. I know that's disturbing to some of you. But it's a frequent widower. And for a long time, you check the cholesterol in the blood, and if it's high, you're in trouble. And if you can keep it at 150, you can just remember that figure. You're in great shape. I'll put it down. I'll put it up and down, I guess, so you can all get a shot. All right. Fat in the blood, and it just doesn't roll around there. Fat. It's tied up with a protein complex, and there are four kinds there. You see, chylomicrons, and very low density lipid, and high density lipid. What you'll hear most of in the papers is LDL or low density, and now high density lipid, and we're going to go into that a bit. And the cholesterol in the blood is carried mainly by the low-density lipid, which is about 80%, okay? And then some by HDL, high-density lipid, which varies. And then the triglycerides are mainly the chylomicrons and the VLDLs. And I'll tell you a little more about that. Now this really was discovered. The high-density lipids, we think they're the good ones now. If you got high-density lipid cholesterol, you're one up on us. It's not all bad, see? That's good, we think. This week. And it was a guy named Bard Cornell, 1951. He said, you know, as I'm looking over these patients, those people that have a high coronary heart disease rate, huh? They have very low high density lipid in the blood. And the correlation really looked good. And vice versa, if they had a lot of low density lipid, They were at high risk.
And I should tell you that what they're proposing now for high-density lipid is that it does facilitate secretion of cholesterol. In other words, I should tell you about,
I guess a little bit about what happens in coronary heart disease or atherosclerosis or atheromatous plaques. And your vessels are lined with an inner layer called the intima, and a media layer which is next to it, as you might suspect, and then there's some on the outside. But those are the only two we're going to talk about. And what probably happens is that something damages the intima, and then, of course, cholesterol is handled by the vessels, but. But if you have a high amount there, and especially if you have high blood pressure, there's more lipid going through, and it accumulates here in this place. And also what happens, this smooth muscle, and some people propose the three principal theories on the causation, all came out of the University of Washington. Three of the principal ones in the world today came out of there. And one of them, Bendit, they feel that maybe it starts with one smooth muscle cell, and it goes from there. But in a way, these atheromatous plaques form, and then they might lay down calcium, and they harden up, and then you might have some bleeding. They might even ulcer. They might form a thrombus, and then it might break off and clot. But in a way, the vessel, your pipes get sort of rusted and clogged. That's what's happening, and when this happens on the heart, you're in trouble. And I have bad news for you that we found this out in the Korean War. We knew it in pigs a long time ago. When the pig is very young, he already shows this fatty streaking, and he may show atheromatous plaques early in life. I think at least a quarter of the young lads who were killed in Korea, a lot of them had fatty streaks, and I think a quarter of them had coronary vessels that were already plaqued up, at least one, at the age of 18 to 22. So it starts early in some people. I don't know why I told you that,
Now, the correlative studies in many places substantiate now the high density lipid to, and it was correlated with high heart disease, that low high density lipid. And they feel that it might facilitate cholesterol. Yeah, now I know why. Because what they think is that the low density lipid is what carries the cholesterol and it deposits the stuff, and then this wonderful high density lipid comes along and moves it out. And takes it to the liver, and then it's excreted. At least that's one theory. And they have, in fact, labeled cholesterol to people, and they have then checked and found out that it was labeled, was found in a high-density lipid, and in excretion. But this is still to be confirmed. And I may mention the Framingham study in New York. In 1949, they set up a study of several thousand people, men and women, who didn't have any coronary heart disease or any signs of it. And they check them out with a complete physical exam every 2 years. And this has been going on now. And I think they were aged, what, somewhere around 50 to, no, I mean 30 to 58 or something when they started. So some of them have died. And a lot of the data is going on them. They, of course, didn't have high-density lipids on them early because they didn't know how to do it. And it's only within this decade that they've really got a good method for determining high-density lipid. But they've been doing it now for a while. And in checking back on their people, they found this. That this was really true. And I should also say that the Framingham study says, now I've listed a whole bunch of variables here. Now, very few of these variables alone
will increase your chances of having a fatal heart attack within 8 years. If you don't have any of these things wrong with you, you only have about a 2% chance of dying in an 8 year period in somewhere around, I suppose, 50. But if you have all five of these, your chances are about 49% of having a fatal heart attack. So when you combine them up, you got a problem. Now it's also interesting that on high density lipid, that we all knew women were superior to men, and they have more high density lipid than men. They're about running about 45, that's the average, versus women are 55. And for every 5 points that you're below 45, every five milligrams below that, the risk increases 25% of having a fatal heart attack. You can ignore some of the other stuff. But now, of course, if this is good, what can we do about increasing the high-density lipid? That's a pretty good idea. I should tell you, there's a tremendous amount of effort right now going on to figure out, number one, is there a possibility of regression of the plaques? And there's a lot of feeding trials and everything, because some of this came out of the war. People like myself, who were starved for a time, and the various countries like Norway and England, they found out that when they went through a period of starvation, and the blood lipids went down, that there seemed to be a lower incidence of coronary heart disease. And some of them said, well, it's all because of the reduction in fat. Well, it turns out, and I won't go into the data, but it's very good proof and data, epidemiological proof, both in Norway and England, that it wasn't correlated as far as its time appearance. But what does increase high-density lipid? Well, if you're an alcoholic, your high-density lipid is around 85 or 90. It's double the average. You say, well, that must be good. Well, there are other problems. So you have to always weigh this. And I bring that out because, you know, just because it happens to be good there, that isn't any sign that I recommend that you all become alcoholics to raise your high-density lipid. The cost is too great. And we can look at a few of them down here. I wrote down. There's a lot of things. You notice I didn't mention exercise in here, did I? Or overweight. Well, what about exercise? I gave you my spoof on exercise a couple of days ago. On running versus sitting, or jogging versus sitting, because I'm a reformed jogger, and it's a hazard from the standpoint there. You got to weigh one thing against another, but we know that running, or those people that run, I should say the people that run have higher amount of high density lipids. They're 15 or 20 points higher if they run 7 miles a week. Or so. They're up around 60, 65. A fellow at Stanford showed that. He was running his own blood against somebody else's, and he was a runner. And he was wondering about this, so he went back and checked it. Now, we also know that if you drink a little bit of booze, that your high density lipid goes up. I only mentioned alcoholics, but you've been just, you know, one a day sort of increases a bit. So we said exercise does it. And smoking will reduce it, high-density lipid. So, but then you have to then study this. And I again throw another complex issue into it. See if you're a runner. What is the characteristic of a runner? It turns out that runners drink a little more than the non-runners, at least in the studies they've done. They don't smoke as much as other people. And they're leaner than other people. And all three of those things probably contribute to having high density lipids. So the plot thickens.
And we know there's always the problem of the pill and estrogens and progesterone. At a certain time of life, there's some indication of that estrogens may protect. Some of them use that as an excuse in women. And so that's where that is. What else to say about that? I'll save my fat stuff till the cancer stuff. Okay, that's cancer stuff. Some of the other data. In the statistics, in Cotter Gudbrandsen's and others, there's been a lot of work on this. And they found out in looking at what a person did made a lot of difference. If you were the bus driver versus the guy that collected the tickets and kept running back up and down the stairs in these two-level buses in England, there was a lot of difference in the incidence of heart disease between those two groups. The guys that were running back up and down the stairs, talking to people and all, I mean, that may have figured into it too. But they didn't have as much heart disease. Or in the post office, those people that were sitting there in the post office flicking the letters, you know, in the various boxes versus those guys who were carrying it down the street and delivering them. There was a lot of difference in the incidence of heart disease. Or those people that were doing manual labor, that group had a lower incidence than those who didn't. So we think that exercise does at least two things. Now, some of the exercise people, is the cardiologist here?
Yeah, Steve.
Okay. Now he'll want to say something about this and tell you where I'm going wrong. I've talked to a lot of cardiologists. I sired one, and he's pretty well trained, and he's fairly good cardiologist, I think. And I've talked to quite a few others in this, and we know at least two things about it that most of them will say we got fairly good proof of it. And that is that running makes you feel a little better, and it probably has better flow through your pipes. Your pipes are probably end up being a little better as far as the amount of blood flow that's permitted through them. And I suppose there's some indication, and the cardiologist will express his views on this relative to, there's some indication that high blood pressure might reduce some, but I'm not ready to quote you the data on this. Some of them say that coronary circulation is increased. I do not know of any certain evidence in this, although it's often cited. Why don't you mention a little bit about how do you feel about exercise? Because you're red hot for it, and you've done a lot of work on it.
Sure, yeah, thank you. I wouldn't want to go under a title of anything, but my name is Steve Arnold, and I think I'm right with you in all of your presentation. As you say, there are a lot of fads in medicine, as there are in religion and everything else. And it is sort of an exciting mystery story, and everyone's trying to unravel it, and the stakes are high, as you pointed out, with such a tremendous amount of death. And there's a whale of a lot of good news in the risk factor story that you've been saying, of reversible things that you can do. And a Christian has a certain obligation in speaking out on these things. And you've underlined cigarette smoking, and I would re-underline it, and I think we need to use the language of sin. Once again, we've gotten away from that language because we don't want to judge each other and be judged and so on. But the evidence in cigarette smoking is so profound, beyond circumstantial evidence, that the voice needs to speak out once again in a loving way, and certainly not in a holier-than-thou way, but in a caring way. And I would say that to begin with. In terms of things on exercise, the latest things which have come out, which when you say something's latest, it isn't to say it's best, it's to say it's most suspect or to be looked at further. But certainly exciting and interesting is that there's no longer such a thing as people being overweight, which is good news to a lot of people that look at scales. But there is such a thing as being overfat. And overfat is now measured in a different way. It's not measured on the scale. It's measured by a kind of new baptism in which the person is submerged in water and weighed underwater. And the very interesting thing is that fat people float and muscle people sink. And that it's a very interesting observation to see that people that can be normal weight by Metropolitan Life insurance tables can be overfat. We had one girl who had a disease or an illness or a problem called anorexia nervosa, which means you don't eat because you're nervous or something. And she was 5'4" and 84 pounds, and she was overfat. She was 24% body fat, whereas a woman should be 22% or less. Her problem was not weight, it was fat. She simply had starved herself of muscle, had no protein in muscle, and was overfat. We've seen other people that are overweight by every table and yet maybe 15 or 10% body fat. This type of approach is very exciting and explains why people that have just looked at weight in terms of heart disease have missed the boat. Get back to what you asked me to comment about on exercise. What exercise does in a very exciting way is change the way you handle food. Nutritionists in the past have looked at the body as a passive receptacle and what you pour in, and they've analyzed diets. And as you well pointed out, the analysis of diet leads to paradox, confusion, and error. The new approach looks at how the body handles what you put in it. And exercise profoundly changes your metabolism. Everybody that's exercised for the first time and gotten a stiff muscle knows that something happens to your body. For one thing, it hurts. And what's hurting is the generation of new mitochondria at the cellular level. And what they do in a very interesting way is consume fat, which is a very interesting thing. And it explains why the observation we've all had is that some people seem to eat a lot and don't get fat, and others do the opposite. Relates to the amount of those good guys in there called mitochondria that go around gobbling up fat even when you're asleep. And it's a very exciting story. You can have enzyme induction of fat gobbling enzymes on mitochondria. This explains a lot of things like hypoglycemia. The unfit person consumes sugar primarily, and everything they do when they start to move consumes sugar, and it makes them hungry, so they overeat again. So as a primary treatment for a great many things, exercise is coming into vogue, and like all fads and new religions and things, you can attribute too much to it. But the realm of things which have been discovered recently to be treated by exercise, and by that we mean really training, 20 minutes a day of exercise at 80% of your own maximum capacity, which can be measured most simply by the fact that you should be short of breath. If you're short of breath, it counts. If you're not, it doesn't. And when you do that 20 minutes a day, it ends up treating depression, it ends up treating your mitochondria and doing a lot of good things. So, Leo, thanks for letting me make these comments, but I would sort of end up as an advocate of not smoking and of exercising. And your comment about moderation in alcohol presents an interesting Christian commentary. I would not be promoting excessive alcohol nor criticizing those who are against it, but it certainly appears that one a day may keep the doctor away.
well stated. I'll get right to you, Paul. I wanted to say two things there. On you recommend then 20 minutes a day. In the wrap up, I was going to say, you know, 20-30 minutes, maybe even twice a day, and heart rate, depending on what your stable heart rate is, 120 to 150. But you have to again look at each individual. But what you said there is what you tell your patients. Is it, you know, about 20 minutes and you get them up so you're kind of short of breath? And
yeah, it appears in the first 12 minutes of aerobic exercise, meaning oxygen burning, you consume sugars primarily. Now, these metabolic pathways go simultaneously, but the second wind phenomenon and other things that are real things but not completely understood, after 12 minutes, you start stressing your fat-burning pathways, which means just like building muscles, you build those up after 12 minutes.
Now, Paul.
Yeah, along this matter of exercise, there are some of us who, I personally just hate the kind of exercise where you have to go through a routine to do it, but I do a lot of physical labor, splitting wood, carrying wood, hauling stuff from one thing to another, which is heavy work. Is that comparable at all, or wheelbarrowing stuff around in one thing and another, is that a comparably good way to exercise, or?
What kind of isometric and that kind of exercise where you're straining and lifting builds muscle mass, but it's not an aerobic kind of an exercise, and the evidence would suggest that it may lead to certain muscular advantages, but not to cardiac or metabolic.
There's no advantage on cardiac.
As far as can be determined, it's not the aerobic exercise, which is most simply measured by being short of breath. See, if you're short of breath in that effort, then you're doing both aerobic and anaerobic exercise, and there would be some advantage. But that's a pretty simple test, and a lot of people have gotten into heart rate things.
I've been kidding myself for years.
Yeah, the most important...
What do you say on heart rate?
Heart rate can be used, but I think it's sort of difficult to go around feeling your pulse, and its shortness of breath is a better index, I think. It's just the breath test. You should be able to be short of breath, but not so much that you can't talk. And everybody can measure that interval. If you're so short of breath that you simply can't talk, you're too close to maximum and gone too far.
Well, what I do, sometimes I do stop and measure. It also gives me a rest. I'm on my bike and get to the top of the hill from my office. I stop and check it, and then I feel very... like I paid my dues if it's up around 140. And so that takes that's very good. And I wanted to say two things there, that there are some encouraging signs. And the by the next statistics, when they come out, and according to my conversation with Tom Clarkson at Bowman Gray last week, the incidence of deaths from coronary heart disease has fallen since 1970. And I think at the next statistics, when they are released, it'll probably be about a 40% reduction. And that is in cardiac deaths. And now everybody would like to take credit for that. And I don't know the real reasons, and I've tried them out on a few people, and our cardiologists might want to address this. Probably the greatest thing that's happened on this is the control of hypertension. At least that's contributed very remarkably to it. Everybody's very sensitive about that, and I think the drug companies have to have some of the credit. And the people who've done research on this, but they have developed some very good drugs for the control of hypertension. And this has certainly helped. I brought up the subject because there's some fantastic coronary care units now. And they can really save a lot of people they didn't save before. And I brought that up, and he said, well, it's contributed, but you have to realize that 70% of the people that have heart attacks are not within the confines of having accessible to them a coronary care unit. So I don't know. How do you feel about that up here? Do you feel hypertension control is a very critical dimension? Is critical?
Hypertension control certainly is, and control of salt in the diet seems to be a big one. Increasing water in the diet, we've gotten away from water in the diet, which probably is a good thing. And the coronary care units themselves have probably not done as much to save lives as they have to increase care of people in a humane sort of way, of people and their families, and it certainly saved some lives, but there have been recent critics of it showing that you could care for people at home just as you can deliver babies at home. But the problem is that you can't measure it in statistics because there's a few instances where it really makes a difference, same as delivering babies in hospitals.
Yep. So now, let's bring this up. There's probably a lot of other things I should have said. But here's what we're going to do as your family veterinarian. Well, here's what I'm doing for myself, okay? I would make a plea, of course, for the future, that we individualize this, and a cardiologist will probably look at family history, because that is important. It isn't overwhelming, but it's very important. And then you look at the blood lipids and see, because there are some people like, is it Getty? No. The family.
Gebbie.
Yeah. Is he here?
No, he's not.
You see, he is of a group of people. That, you know, he can eat butter all day and whipped cream at night, and his blood lipids are never over 150. And he just belongs to that group. There are others of us who have hyperlipidemia. So we just normally, genetically, have a very high amount of this. And on a regression, I want to say this about regression. There's a very interesting study, probably never be repeated, run by the Heart Institute, National Heart and Lung and Blood and All Institute. And they're using an agent that kind of does something that bile salts. And they went through thousands and thousands of people picking these people out, and it's down to a few thousands in each group. And every day, these people take a pill. And they'll take a pill for the next 5 years. And they're watching their diet. And they're keeping their diet the same. And they were picked for a certain level of. And one of them is getting this drug, and they don't know who it is, and the other one's getting a placebo, see? And then they're going to see after 5 years what it does for the heart, coronary heart disease. And we won't know that till 81 or 82. It started in 77, I think. So there are these kind of studies, but until that comes, it's just a wise plan to consider lean body mass. You know, that is, that you don't get over fat. In saying this, I should say that the death rate in older people is less for those that are a little heavier than I am, who are mildly overweight. The last statistics came out of within the last year of the National Institute of Aging. But you should watch your weight. You should not eat a lot of fat or a lot of anything. And you should get moderate exercise, and you've heard the recommendations on exercise. And you've got to check your blood pressure and have that checked and watch it. And boy, you really watch it. If you got diabetes, boy, handle it. Huh? And don't beat the weed. And that's about where we are. I want to continue. And the other thing is, and get a pet. There's been a recent study. Many of us have been suspicious that something physical happens to you when you have an animal and you want the animal and like the animal. And for example, if I go and pet my pet horse or my pet dog, there's probably an indication that something physically happens to that animal. The blood pressure and the heart rate go down. I have some of my people now, they're supposed to be like Pam Wagner, who's an outstanding equine surgeon. She's supposed to be checking her blood pressure and her heart rate when she is petting her favorite horse, or one of her horses. And I got some of the students, they're supposed to be checking that. What happens to them when they pet their animal? I think something physical may be happening to them. But we're just getting going on this. And I suppose you're surprised that it hasn't been done before, and I'm ashamed to say it hasn't. But there was an interesting study that some of you made the papers. Erica Friedman and Aaron Katcher and a bunch of them at the University of Maryland and up at Penn, University of Pennsylvania. They did a study on a lot of people who had a heart attack or had severe angina pectoris. And they fill out a big sheet on them of the various things that they did. And they just happened to put in there whether they had a pet or not. And then after a year, they examined them, went back to them, and went through them all, and they really did a very good work upon them from the standpoint of cardiovascular and other lines. And they went through all the variables, you see. And when they came to the PET thing, it just flew out at them, because here, 11 out of 39 that didn't have a PET, almost one-third of them, were dead at the end of the year. Where only 3 out of 53 were dead, and those who had PETs. Well, that's pretty significant. And they said, well, it's probably because they got dogs and they go out chasing the dogs. Well, they got checking on that, and those that didn't have dogs but had a pet, none of those had died. So then you say, well, maybe it's a characteristic. Maybe the person has a different personality who has an animal or a pet. And we don't know that. But you see, that's why in all of this I recommend that you get a pet. But you got to like it. You can't be fighting it, you know. I mean, that's something else. But to know one is to love one. They're like your veterinarian. or your cardiologist. Now I'm going to talk about the cancer a bit. And what we got to say about that. Well, I spent a lot of my life looking at cancer and looking at the causes. A lot of it was in viral causation. The laboratory in which I was involved, we discovered quite a few viruses that do induce tumors in animals, to include cattle, woolly monkeys, and most recently the gibbon. Now here is the news. These are women. This is the rate of people dying from cancer per 100,000 in the population. And you see that over the period of 1930 to 1977, that's the latest figures I have relating to this, but I have the 79 figures here. But we haven't really done that much in the breast. And we haven't done much for the colon and the rectum. It's fallen a bit. But all the others have fallen, with one exception, in the lung. And the lung is really going up fast. And it is related to the increase in cigarette smoking among women. And it's sort of catching up with the men, which is here. And you see how the lung is, you know, is way out there in front over the last 25, 30 years. The stomach has gone down remarkably. The colon went up for a while, and now it's sort of leveled off. The prostate is about level. Pancreas, maybe a slight increase. The esophagus and the bladder is holding down about there. So that gives you some kind of a feel for this. And I guess what it tells is that if something has happened to our diet in the recent past, over the last 25 years, it hasn't really deleteriously affected the cancer rate, has it? I mean, because overall, it's either stayed the same or fallen. Isn't that right? At least that's how I read those things. Now, there was a statement made by... I have to back up just one more thing, because unless you're in the question period, will you ask me about B6? B6 is a hot issue right now. Was anybody going to ask me about B6? You were going to, all right, you asked me about B6. All right, so I can keep on this story then. And let's just look at fat intake, because Senator McGovern and his select committee on nutrition, they put out a report, and they were quoting a lot of good scientists, and one of the quotations they made was from Frank Rauscher, who was director then of the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, who is now executive vice president for the American Cancer Society, and a well-known scientist, said that it looks like there's an increase in colon and breast cancer, and that's due, and the culprit is probably animal fat and animal products. So let's do that over a period of time. And it's true that the incidence of heart disease did increase from 1910 to the 40s and 50s. Well, let's look at that. All I'm doing is bringing you the best data that I can find. And here you see fat intake over this period of time from 1909 to 1973 or 4. The total fat has increased somewhat in the United States. The animal fat has, it doesn't show it there, it shows on another one, has fallen about, in some of the material I have, has fallen about 16% since 1910. Vegetable fat has tripled. The intake of vegetable fat has tripled. So if you're going to make a case for animal fat, it ain't there. Now, here is because a lot of the instruction is, you know, is you should knock off the saturated stuff and go to the unsaturated. Well, here is the percent of, the intake as percent of fat in the diet. And you see the animal fat has gone down up there in the top. The unsaturated and the linoleic has gone up somewhat. And overall vegetable, because some of the vegetable fat is saturated, all right? And the total saturated fat hasn't really changed all that much. Now, I'll just mention, I have a little bit on that select committee here, so let's just run through that rapidly. Cancer of the colon and breast, there is a proportionality with dietary fat and the culprit with animal fats. And then, but Enig, Munn, and Keeney, within the less than a year, they have examined this over a 60-year period to look at the proportionality, to see how it relates to total fat, vegetable fat, trans fatty acid, and so forth. But before I go into that in detail, I should show you some other data that's circumstantial. If you look at fat intake, the fat intake of Israel and Greece is about the same, but breast cancer is four times as much in Israel. In Spain, they have a higher intake than France and Italy of fat, but France and Italy have three times the breast cancer rate. Puerto Rico has 88% of their intake of animal fat. It's about the same as ours, but they have much more animal fat intake compared with the vegetable fat versus the United States, only has 62%. Yet the breast cancer in the colon is three times as much in the United States as it is in Puerto Rico. Netherlands and Finland have about the same fat intake, but the animal fat is about the same, but the vegetable fat is four times that in Netherlands versus Finland, and the breast cancer. And the colon cancer in Netherlands is two times as much as in Finland. Southwest American Indian has a high animal fat intake, but a very low breast cancer incidence. In Colombia, the high economic classes, they have four times the colon cancer as the lower economic classes, but they consume considerably less animal fat. Now, they often use the Seventh-day Adventists because they're not hitting the meat very hard. And they do have a lower colon cancer rate because a lot of many of them don't eat any beef. But then they kind of mess up the details. The Seventh-day Adventist physicians have much higher incidence of colon cancer than the non-Seventh-day Adventist physicians. I don't think you're ready to say that the physicians in the Seventh-day Adventist church are eating a lot of meat. At least they wouldn't own up to it. Now, the Rogers and Newbern did some studies on animals, and the incidence of colon tumors with 15% corn oil was much higher than in those animals that had 28% beef fat. And Carroll had a lower mammary tumor incidence in animals fed beef fat than those fed low fat with corn oil. And then we have the trans fatty acid thing, which I'm going to get to in a minute now when I go back to this other one that I gave you. And this is very critical data, and as far as I've been able to determine, I do not know any Munn and Keeney at the University of Maryland, principally. And they studied it then over a 60-year period, looked at the fat data that I have shown you now,
And then they criticized some of the data. Like Winder, he said beef was the major source of saturated fat, and he put that out. Well, here is the data. The intake in the United States of beef is fat from beef is 9.26 per grams per day. Pork is 14.6, and vegetable for the saturated fat is 9.8. So they all beat beef. So you can't really blame this necessarily on the beef. And the vegetable saturated fat has been more than beef since 1928. And the saturated oils. A lot of you say, you know, you use your saturated oils, your oils and all, and your margarine, you're home free. See? Well, don't bank too much on it. Some of you probably use these creamers, these creamers made out of coconut oil, huh? Well, they're 85% saturated. And most of these oils, corn oil, soybeans and all, are 20-25% saturated. Now, what is happening here in, and I should say also the McGovern Committee, quoting Rizak, and he said that an increase in fat intake is chiefly due to animal fat. But their arithmetic was wrong. When you go back to it, they subtracted instead of added. A simple mistake. From 1965 or 72, there was an increase of fat was 11 grams. 1 gram was from animal and 10 grams from vegetable. So that's sort of that. So I'd like to put that record straight. And now let's look at trans fatty acids, because that is of great concern to me. And I don't know where the truth lies in it, except that I know that since 1942, we've known from Tannenbaum's work that he induced cancers with trans fatty acids. Now, trans fatty acids are what is used, put out by Procter & Gamble, I suppose other people, to hydrogenate fats and oils. It's what you hydrogenate to get the solid margarines, huh? And it also keeps a better shelf life, and they keep better. But there's some question, you don't really handle trans fatty acids. It's the same as the cis form of it. It's a different form of the same fatty acid. The cis form is what is necessary in a unsaturated fatty acid. It doesn't act like an unsaturated fatty acid, and I'm not knocking unsaturated fatty acid necessarily. But trans fatty acids, we know, have induced cancer in some instances. The cardiologist also spoke about mitochondria. It does affect the cell membranes. It affects mitochondria. It changes the enzymatic activity. And most of you are probably labeled with at least 77% or more of your calories today are probably in trans fatty acids. And I imagine your fat stores in your body are probably up to 14% trans fatty acids. And I'm not saying that necessarily. It may not be real bad for you, but I'm not ready to say it's good on the basis of the evidence that I've just mentioned to you. And I have grave concern about it. Frankly, I mentioned what you eat. I don't happen to eat very much fat at all, but I sure don't eat margarines. I prefer butter.
Is that Crisco as well? Any of those vegetable shortenings?
Yeah, all the vegetable shortenings, they're very hot. Yeah, I suppose the vegetable shortenings are up 85% or something. And some of them are 50% trans fatty acids. So I have grave concern. I don't want you to, you know, throw everything out. But I'm here to tell you that, you know, in you who are young, and you look back on, if you remember it, some sheep herder talk to you. You know, 20 years from now, and he says, "Well, we were really primitive. We really didn't know anything. Huh? Boy, they were telling us this crazy stuff." And that's where we are. We're just rubbing two sticks together, huh? As far as biomedical science, and we've made more advances. There have been more advances made during my lifetime in science than any period in history, probably in the total history before this. Yet biomedical sciences are so complex. There's so many simple things we don't even know. And so I to an extent plead ignorance. And you're going to ask me about B6. This is a hot issue right now, because there's a fellow named McNulty,
a fellow named McNulty at Cornell. At Harvard. A lot of people, when it comes out of Harvard, sometimes they read it. Yale men don't, but a lot of people want to. And a lot of the people like Prevention Magazine, who are Roland Dale or whatever his name is, he's dead now, but who are pushing diet over everything else. See? It's diet, and that's everything. And so they're hot for it. But pyridoxine, and I worked on, it's a vitamin B6, or pyridoxine, or pyridoxal, or pyridoxamine, all three of them. They come under the vitamin B6 complex. And we did these studies back in the 40s, late 40s, with Cunha on what it done to pigs. And I knew something was happening to the fat metabolism in this, because they really were crazy, and they got a high step and on a deficiency. It turns out it is a coenzyme, and it's involved in the conversion of some amino acids, like tryptophan to niacin. But it's also, they feel, it's involved in affecting homocysteine. Now, one of the requirements for you, among the amino acids, there's at least 10, I guess. How many are there now?
16.
Is it 16 required amino acids? I don't know, but there's a lot of them. Well, one of them is methionine. And methionine is said to go to homocysteine. And McNulty's thesis is that if you don't have enough pyridoxine, homocysteine isn't converted from its... Homocysteine is bad news. And he says homocysteine gets in those vessels and chomps out a piece of the intima, and then the cholesterol comes in and forms the plaque. He says that's the initial lesion. In the absence of pyridoxine, or in low amounts. And the reason that you are pyridoxine deficient today is that the canners and all of that destroys it. Canning, heat, and all of that. Okay. So, that's the story on that. And also the nutritionists will say, well, you shouldn't hit the... you should eat bananas instead of beef, even though you require methionine. And there isn't as much, there's pyridoxine in it, but there's too much methionine. You don't want too much methionine, because unless you have a lot of pyridoxine. But they say if you have a lot of pyridoxine, and they have, of course, they have in early tests, I think over at the University of Washington, I think in some monkeys, a couple other places, and I think McNulty, he injected homocysteine and produced atherosclerosis, and I think he claims in the rabbit that he also had, in a deficiency of pyridoxine, thought there was atherosclerosis. In the monkeys, they claim to have produced atherosclerosis in a B6 deficiency. But that's when I've said that, that's about all I know about it, unless somebody here wishes to comment further on it. I should say, on the preparation, there is a good deal of evidence now, very recently, that high temperatures, for example, on meats and a lot of things, is bad news from the standpoint of carcinogenesis. I've quit. I love, you know, when you go to a beef dinner and you ask for the outside cut, you know. Just like everything, when you get old, you find out, you know, I love chocolate, and it's no more. Rye bread I loved. When I grew up, you know, rye bread, that was health personified, you know. Boy, if it's rye bread, it's got to be healthy. Huh? And my mother made the best rye bread in the world. And boy, I ate it, and I always had a bellyache. But it couldn't be rye bread, see. Well, I finally figured out, it took me a long time, I finally figured out it was rye bread. That's one of the things that gives me a bellyache. There's quite a few other things too. But and then our daughter, she likes to bake bread. I says, well, you're baking a lot of bread, huh? Oh boy, I have all kinds of tummy aches. I says, probably, are you making any rye bread? Oh yeah, boy, that's the best. I says, why don't you knock it off? Well, when I tell my children anything, that's the signal that they probably won't do it. But she, belly hurt enough so that she tried it. And the rye bread does the same for her, see? And I make that point again, that we're not all the same. For some of you, rye bread's great, and you're doing all right. in certain animals, and chickens, they can't take it either, can they? Rye, isn't that right? I think, Mac, I think in some of the studies, rye was no good for chickens. They didn't do well with it. So maybe I'm chicken, but I am in some ways. But I wanted to bring out again this individuality. And as we progress, I think, in medicine, when you come in and we'll do the whole profile on you, including the kind of pet you should have, but your whole biomedical profile, and we'll say, for you, this is what's going to work, as far as we know. And for the next person, it's different, see? Because we are uniquely, we are all unique creators of God, and because we are a unique creation, we got to respect this thing. It's the only one we'll have. And my plea to you who are young, don't wait till you're my age to do some of the things that I've told you to do. Yes.
I'd like you to comment on what would be your feelings about having blood pressure cuff and a stethoscope in every house, so that people could monitor their own blood pressures and really screen in the homes for hypertension.
Yeah, the question.
Did you hear the question?
The question was whether you should have a blood pressure cuff in your own home, and I think it's a good idea if you don't make it a new idol. In other words, I think you can get so hung up in your own health that you enjoy. That you miss the enjoyment and fun in life, but it's a good thing to measure, and you can become a local servant in the community, and you can save a lot of medical costs. You don't have to go then get blood pressure measured, and you can work with your physician in regulation by monitoring at home. I would encourage anybody that does that to have it checked with a mercury gauge in an office, because the errors can be very serious in the type of puff-up cuffs.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I mean, I belong to the Pullman Aging Council. I'm a charter member of the Pullman Aging Council. And you look at me and figure that out, but it really wasn't because of my age, but I had a unique idea for them, and they liked it, so on. And I won't tell you that about it, but we pushed, you know, going out and doing these things, and then where they could do their own. The thing that I resist there is that you set up in the middle of the parking lot downtown and run everybody through. That is not, I don't think, the way to get blood pressure. Because you should be in a restful state. Go along with that. I mean, you run them in there, and they say, hey, there's the outfit, and they run over there, and you know, and that's not the time to take blood pressure.
In fact, I'd like to ask Steve, what should be the practice? How daily? 5 days in a row, or X number of days a week, or how consistent should be this home daily measurement of your blood pressure if you have the equipment and learned how to use it?
The question was how often to measure your blood pressure, and it really depends on where it is to begin with. If it's low normal, then measuring it once or twice a year, and if, particularly in your family history, as Leo said, it's a factor, and if nothing's changing and everything's constant, then once or twice a year is plenty. Leo, could I ask you a question to comment on your thoughts on hair analysis? It's something that I'm very ignorant about, and you may be able to help me on that. Many people that are into prevention, nutrition, so on, this has become a fad, and I need to know more about it.
Yeah, we used to do a lot of hair analysis. I haven't done much on people, but it is an indication of quite a few things in the radioactive age. In our animals, where we're feeding radioactive materials and making analysis of them, you could predict certain things, For what we are talking about today, I'm not ready to, you know, tell you that hair analysis is going to do that much for you at this stage. And frankly, I'm not up on it as much as I should be, as I was when I was at the University of California, and we looked at a lot of beagle hair. I'll clue you in. Yes.
One thing we haven't mentioned that might be we haven't got time today, but that might be a good thing to discuss maybe in some future seminars, and that is 2.1. The value of the will to live in this whole matter. Another point, the value of recreation and hobbies in prolonging a person's life. I think a lot of us like to know about it.
Yeah, I'm going to get that into that a little bit today when I tell you where we went wrong in raising kids. And play and celebration is very important. But they run statistics on this, and for old people, especially who are famous, holidays and their birthday. They usually die after them than before.
Oh.
That's right. More of them die after than before. They have the will to live to that holiday, and then they die, and it's statistically significant. So there is such a thing as a will to live. That's one of the reasons I'm pushing pets, because you have something for an old person living alone to live for. And if you haven't seen this situation, and there's several people in this room that can tell you about that. Yes, two
comments from a public health viewpoint.
Yes.
One, really to underscore the fact that in the chronic diseases, there isn't a perfect answer along the line of the way we've controlled communicable diseases in the past, that there isn't going to be a magic answer that we can vaccinate everybody with. But here in the Northwest, we live in three states with horrible records on vaccinations for the communicable diseases. And while we're all sitting around thinking about these very complex approaches to dealing with lengthening our lives as adults, I think we need to keep in mind the basic patterns of vaccinations and good health practices for children, and look at what we have done in falling behind in those areas, particularly lately in the Pacific Northwest.
Make that case again at 4, if I don't. It's very, very important. Nigel.
In what ways is our diet at Holden Village reflective of your scientific recommendations towards the kitchen fare? And which ways isn't it? In other words, given what you just said, are our meals reflective of some of this research?
They're feeding the Fifth Amendment, I guess. I would say that for a majority of the people, eating the diet you are at Holden, you'd be far better off than the one that the majority of you are eating down in the Flatlands. I think that's true. I've done an analysis of this, and I've made certain recommendations.
In other words, it's not city food or flatland food, but it's not also Coors beer, huh?
Yeah, I guess I'd have trouble with the amount of trans fatty acids in the diet here. I have an argument relative to no beef. As the bad guy, from the standpoint of economics and looking at the world picture says this: if you're going to feed the world over the next by the year 2000, you're not going to feed them on wheat and barley. What is the good agricultural land for this, which we are incidentally losing at a terrible rate, which I told you about the other night, because you can't be row cropping the way we are, and you can't produce enough of grains to feed the world on the territory that we have. There's only, 1.5 to 2%, maybe up to 3% of the land mass is tillable to produce the cereal grains. I'm not knocking cereal grains. But there's 70% of the land mass of the world that produces, that is productive of pasture and browse and everything, that we can't eat. And God's creature, the ruminant, was specially designed to produce outstanding quality protein from this material. And if I were here, if I were a dictator, I guess I'd say, we are having beef today. You don't have to feed very much of it, but that's up to them. I'm not telling them. I'm only advisory. But I would say we are feeding beef today, and it's range beef, huh? Because you can get beef today that never had any grain at all, huh? And your lamb, a lot of the lamb produced today, they don't know what a piece of oats looks like. But they have converted material we can't eat to very first-rate protein. And for people, especially pregnant people, for your source of B12, there's really no source of B12 outside of of the meats unless you want to take it out of the bottle. If you forget to take it out of the bottle, you're in trouble. And I can prove it with a lot of efficiency. So I guess that's a tough question, and I'm not knocking it. I think that we made a quantum jump relative to diet here.
Yeah.